case for argument, United States versus Barnett. Mr. Gohmert.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jim Gohmert. I represent the appellant Curtis Barnett here today. This matter relates to consent, Fourth Amendment, waiver, and the rights of an individual relative to his rights within his home, his rights to be free from governmental intrusion within that home. The individual in question, Mr. Barnett, he's a probationer, yes. I was just about to say, the individual in question is a particular type of individual. He's a probationer. And as such, the appellant readily accedes to the fact that there is no warrant requirement as it pertains to a search of his home. In point of fact, there probably isn't even a probable cause requirement as it pertains to a search of his home. It is, however, our submission that there should be deemed by this court to be, at the very least, a reasonable and articulable basis to being held by government to effectuate a search of his home while he is on probation.
Notwithstanding, what does his agreement say?
He signed an agreement.
I didn't ask you that. What does it say?
That agreement? That agreement is a blanket waiver.
Right. Blanket waiver.
Carte blanche.
The conditions of his probation.
I have to, and as I did at the district.
So if he hadn't signed, he would have been sent to jail, right?
Right.
So it was in his interest to consent. Why should we hardly help probationers to say they can't agree to this, they have to go to jail instead, right?
There's four reasons why I submit to you that an individual, or why you should narrowly construe this contract.
We should
contract.
Add something to it.
Yes, I think that it's been a long time since I had Dean Immel in contracts class, but I'm asking you to narrowly tailor the contract, because it is a contract, and there's four reasons why you should not enforce this blanket waiver. Number one, I believe that the language found in Griffin versus Wisconsin at page 837 of that opinion, decided in 1987, flat out says a probationer's home, like anyone else's, is protected by the Fourth Amendment's requirement that searches be reasonable.
The question is, what can you waive? Now, what are your reasons for thinking that he shouldn't be permitted to waive that right?
My reasons are that the protections that an individual, even a probationer or a parolee, because they dovetail as well, or someone who's on mandatory supervised release, as they call it now.
That's not responsive. The question is, why should he not be permitted to waive that, right? I can post a sign outside my house. Anyone who wants to come in is free to come in, right? I can do that. So why can't he sign a similar waiver as a way of keeping out of jail?
He can sign it. The question
why
is,
why shouldn't it be enforced?
He could sign a document, Your Honor, saying,
I know he can sign. Why is it not in his interest for agreements such as this to be enforceable? Because it enables him to keep out of jail. He has a choice. He can make himself basically transparent to the authorities, waive all his privacy interests, or he can go to prison. And if he prefers the first, why should we tell him, no, you have to go to prison?
Because it's my respectful suggestion to you that a proper balance between government and the individual, even an individual on probation, requires a reasonable and articulable basis.
No. He wants this transparency. He would prefer to sacrifice his privacy than to go to prison. So how are you balancing governmental and personal interests? They both want this.
They do both want this. The government doesn't want to pay for him to be in prison.
Look, balance is where there's disagreement. One person wants privacy, the government wants security, something like that. That's balancing. Now, if both the government and the individual want this privacy waiver, what are you balancing against? What other interest is there?
Judge, there has been analysis of blanket waivers of this type, both in Griffin versus Wisconsin and USA versus Knights, decided in 2001. And I know that in USA versus Knights, they said we're not going to analyze whether you can blanket waiver
right,
sign this away.
Right, it's an open question now.
It's an open question, and it's before you now.
Side. What reason is there not to close it in favor of saying these deals are enforceable?
Ample potential for governmental abuse as it pertains
to... What's the abuse?
Probation officer doesn't like the probationer. Probation officer's going to come out to the probationer's house every night, going to search every night because he signed that waiver. Could go into the neighbor's house by mistake, find something. Who knows? It might come in because he, in good faith, believed that he was searching a probationer's house as opposed to the
and
neighbor's
that
house.
That mistake is possible in any... you allow police to search, of course they may make a mistake. That's nothing special to this deal.
I do think that this is a situation that is potentially rife for governmental abuse as it pertains to a probation officer or a probation office and the individual probation.
Well, here, didn't they have internal safeguards? Didn't he ask permission to go search? The probation officer? His own.
My recollection of the testimony, there was four witnesses who testified at trial. George Chester, the supervisor in St. Clair County's intensive probation, who had indicated that he'd gone up the chain of command in the state's attorney's office to procure reasonable. He testified that he believed he had a reasonable basis. That testimony was rejected by the district court judge. There was testimony from two probation officers, Your Honor.
I was merely getting to your opportunity for abuse. That is, internally, there a probation officer just couldn't go out on his own and make a search every night, as you said.
My recollection is that they said they were coming in one way or another.
Well, still, my question again, wasn't there an internal safeguard where the line's probation officer had to go to a supervisor to get permission to make a search?
That was by the policy manual.
Right.
Which I'm doing all that I can to... I tried as hard as I could at the district court level, and I'm trying hard here to get in, because the policy manual, which is the second prong of my brief, actually flat out states that probation has to have a reasonable basis. So it runs at cross currents with what is signed by the probationer in March of 2003.
Except that,
or is
that
it
policy
the
statement. The policy statement relates to probation in general, not to intensified probation, though, doesn't it?
With all due deference, I think that if you examine Exhibit C, there is specific reference to the IPS unit in the paragraph immediately prior to. It's specific to IPS.
What page are you referring to, please?
I think it's page 137 of the search and seizure policy, and it's Exhibit 3 of my brief. It says only IPS has the authority to search an individual's home or auto, and then it dovetails into the references to having reasonable suspicion and then going up the chain of command, going to your supervisor, and then ultimately passing that on to the state's attorney. So I think that there is a reference to only IPS having an individual the authority to search a home.
Now, your second argument is that there was no agreement reached because the discrepancy between the what he signed and the manual.
I would say...
Well, that's what you said in your brief, no agreement. Do you want to take that back now, or what?
I think that's actually my third argument, Your Honor, which
Yeah, it's your third argument, although it's also made earlier.
And quite frankly, there's not a whole lot to that, and I will take it back to tell you the truth. I do not take back, however, my second argument, which makes every effort on my part to indicate to you, as I indicated to the district court judge, that this policy manual should have application in this situation and that this court should require that a reasonable and articulable basis be had by probation. They had nothing here. I know that the Knights Court said that it's dubious logic. I realize I'm out of time.
Okay, well, we'll give you a minute after we hear from Ms. Scott.
Morning, Your Honors. My name is Angie Scott. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Illinois, and I represent the United States in this matter. In this matter, the district court found that the consent and the provision that Mr. Barnett signed as a condition of intensive probation constituted a waiver of all of his Fourth Amendment rights. We would ask this court affirm that decision. In making this decision, the district court relied on Zapp v. United States, a 1946 Supreme Court case, which in that case, Zapp had entered into a contract with the Navy Department, and in part of that contract had said that they had access to his business records, and the Supreme Court said that when the Navy went in and actually searched his accounts and records, that Zapp had waived that any privacy rights to those business records by agreeing to that contract, that he specifically got the benefit of entering into a contract with the government in return for waiving those
Well, are
rights.
There any limitations on this paragraph 10C about submitting to searches of your person, etc.? Can the probation officer just show up at, 2 a.m. and knock on the door and say, I'm going to search you?
Well, and from the face of the document, it doesn't appear as if there are any contingencies other than the fact that... I'm sorry, could I have 1 second? It does specifically state that probation has the ability to search his house at any time. Any time requests are made by the probation officer. As Judge Keeney pointed out earlier, in this case, there was testimony by the supervisor that he had some kind of suspicion that Mr.
Yes, I know. My question is about the meaning of this 10C. Is it as broad as it seems to be? Are there any implied limitations on it?
According to the testimony at the suppression hearing, there is not. I mean, the probation officers testified that their understanding of this clause is that they can go in at any time to search as a condition of intensive probation.
A little hard to take seriously. So what, they can just camp out in the person's house and search him every 10 minutes?
Well, again, in this case, in this particular case...
I know this case. The question is the meaning of this agreement.
The meaning of this agreement is what it says, that they can't, that the probationer has to submit to searches at any time.
So you could have the probation officer move in with him and say, and I'm going to search you every hour.
Your Honor, I think that would be a situation that most likely wouldn't happen. I think in this case,
I know it wouldn't, unlikely to happen. The question is whether it is, however, permitted by the agreement.
Well, and it doesn't say that. What it says, Your Honor, again, is that the probationer must submit to searches upon request by a probation officer. And there are no limitations. You're correct in that there are no limitations and that probable cause is required or that any type of reasonable suspicion is required, which is
very broad, and it says submit his person, property, place of residence, vehicle, personal effects to search at any time, with or without a search warrant, warrant for arrest, or reasonable probable cause by any probation officer or law enforcement officer.
Okay, Your Honor, I think that... the provision that you just quoted was the provision that was in the Knights case,
right.
And the Supreme Court in that case said, or did not look at that provision and say, hey, this is horrible, I can't believe that that probation officer could do that. Again, our provision is similar in some respects, although it doesn't contain the language about without a search warrant, warrant of arrest, or reasonable cause, but it does say at any time. It does not put any contingencies on there.
Doesn't include law enforcement officer, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the testimony in this case was that the search was actually conducted by a probation officer, but that he had law enforcement officers accompany him in case there was any problems or contraband found.
And that's part of the liberty that the probationer gives up when he consents to probation.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we would again point to the language in, I believe the language in People versus Bravo, which we think is exactly what's happened here. Bravo looked at the difference between probationers and parolees and said that in this case, probationers have the option of taking this search condition or going to jail. If the probationer says, if Mr. Barnett would have looked at this condition of intensive probation and said, I'm not going to submit to searches, then he could have taken the option of going to jail.
And there are some who do that, too.
And this is not the situation where when he's on parole or in the federal system, supervised release, where these restrictions are imposed on him. This was his choice. This was a bargain for agreement. He consented to his waiver of Fourth Amendment rights, and we believe that his consent encompassed all of his Fourth Amendment rights, that there are no reasonable requirements.
Your opponent's arguing the policy statement with regard to the fact that there's an indication of reasonable suspicion necessary.
And the search and seizure policy does have that language in there, and the testimony at the suppression hearing by Mr. Chester was that that he understood it to be a reasonable suspicion. However, the line probation officers Sidney Williams and Rodney Skinner, who both testified, said that what they understood was that there was this general policy, but that under the conditions of intensive probation, they were allowed to search under those conditions. Now, it was never asked of Mr. Chester whether he understood it that way also. In fact, I cite in my brief, too, Mr. Williams was specifically asked whether his understanding was that only IPS could search with reasonable suspicion, and his response was, no, that we go by what's in the conditions of intensive probation.
Well, did the probation officer consult a superior here, or was acting on his own?
No, my understanding is that George Chester directed Skinner, who's a surveillance officer, a little different than a regular probation officer, to conduct a search. And Mr. Skinner did testify that he was going to conduct the search no matter what. However, he testified that he was acting at the direction of Mr. Chester, that he didn't just pop up on Mr. Barnett's door.
What is this statement in your brief? Is this a reference to something else when you say George Chester sought approval from the St. Clair County State Attorney's Office?
That's correct, Your Honor. There was testimony at the suppression hearing that Mr. Chester, based on the actions of Mr. Barnett, there was an encounter with Mr. Barnett in the probation office, that based on his nervousness that he believed...
Was this the search involved in this case?
It was, Your Honor. However, we did not argue below, nor do we argue now, that there was reasonable suspicion based on what Mr. Chester said to conduct the search. What we're saying is, look, this is a blanket waiver. He consented to a search of his house anytime, anywhere, and it doesn't...
But now Chester was a supervisor. Was there a probation officer different from Chester assigned to Barnett, or
yes,
was
sir.
He his probation officer?
No, sir. The probation officer that was assigned to Mr. Barnett was Sidney Williams, and Mr. Williams...
So I asked you, so this search was actually directed by a supervisor after consultation with the state's attorney.
That's the testimony at the suppression hearing, correct, Mr. Chester?
Well, now, is that the practice? Could Williams have shown up at, you know, Barnett's door and said, "I've come to search you," without consulting Chester or anyone else?
Your Honor, the testimony was at the suppression hearing again was that Mr. Chester believed that the policy required him to have reasonable suspicion, and he directed the officers to go search Mr. Barnett's home that night based on what he believed was reasonable suspicion. And Mr. Skinner, or I'm sorry, the person who actually conducted the search was Mr. Skinner, that's right. And he said, yeah, we went there at the direction of Mr. Chester, and we searched the place. We were going to search it no matter what.
So you're saying that Williams' understanding was that he required reasonable suspicion?
No, Your Honor.
Whose understanding was that?
Mr. Chester was never asked what Mr. Williams and Mr. Skinner were asked, which is that despite this policy manual, what the policy manual says...
Who was the one who said he thought they needed reasonable suspicion?
Mr. Chester testified that the policy manual does specify reasonable suspicion, and he testified that he believed that he had reasonable suspicion, and that on that basis he consulted the state's attorney's office, received their permission, and then directed Mr. Skinner to conduct the search.
But so does that mean Chester's interpretation of intensive supervision is that intensive probation is that it's to be interpreted in light of the manual and that reasonable suspicion is required?
Your Honor, and that was a question that was never asked of Mr. Chester, so I do not know if that was his interpretation of
Why did he bother with reasonable suspicion? Why did he bother to consult the state's attorney? Why didn't he just, you know, act on the basis of the agreement and simply order Williams to conduct the search?
Again, I do not know why Mr. Chester did not do that, because that was not something that was asked of him at the suppression hearing. However, when both probation officers were asked the question, how do you interpret how you can search under this condition of intensive probation, they both responded, we understand it to mean that we can search at any time. And I see that I'm
okay. Thank you, Ms. Scott. So Mr. Gomrich, we'll give you a minute if you have anything to note.
I believe the court has hit upon something that is of interest in my mind, and that is that they put forward testimony from George Chester, which suggested that he sought permission. He believed he needed reasonable suspicion, and when the court at the district court level said that I don't find there to have been reasonable suspicion, then they want to say, well, a blanket waiver was sufficient. I do believe that the search and seizure policy is pertinent here as it pertains to St. Clair County. I think that they needed reasonable suspicion by way of that search and seizure policy. I also believe that this court is in an unusual position in that it is sitting by way of a de novo review, and there is little or no precedent one way or another that binds it to its decision. It can do as it sees fit. The government has made references to some state court decisions out west. I have pointed you to the Illinois Supreme Court decision of Illinois versus Lampetock. The Illinois Supreme Court has held in searches of this type that a reasonable suspicion is required. I also think, and I know that the court in the Knights case says that this logic is dubious, but I do have to say that I think it's fair to say that if the United States Supreme Court truly believed that blanket waivers of this type were legally enforceable, then they would have never undertaken analysis.
That's just conjecture. No. Who knows what they would have done?
You're off on a spin now.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Mr. Gomrich and Ms. Scott. Okay.